Hey, Proof listeners. Plougra's premium European-style butter is a favorite of bakers. Why? Cook's Illustrated recipe developer, Erica Turner, sums it up.
Hey, Kevin. Did you know that the kind of butter you use when you're baking can actually make a difference in how your dish turns out?
I did not.
Butters that are slow-churned, like Plougra, are easier to work with because they make doughs more pliable. The amount of fat in the butter also makes a difference.
Tell me more.
Okay, so most American butters contain around 80% butterfat, but European-style butters, like Plougra, have a higher fat content. In fact, Plougra Premium European-style butter always contains 82% butterfat.
And you're saying 2% is enough to make a noticeable difference?
Oh, yeah, definitely. With Plougra Slow Churn Butter and its 82% butterfat content, you'll notice richer, flakier pastries, cakes that rise higher, and cookies that crisp more easily.
Embrace your inner butter lover, from professional kitchens to your home. Visit Plougra.com for more information. I fondly remember the time I was 10, and it was the first time that I had snake. It was served in a soup, and it was something my Chinese relatives made. And the snake came in these tiny slivers that, frankly, you could barely taste. It was like strands of chicken breast, really. Now, I didn't say I enjoyed it. In fact, I hate snakes. I'm scared of them. But no one told me I had eaten snake until after the fact, because they knew I had a phobia and I would have never touched it. Anyway, I was angry. But soon, anger turned into this kind of pride. And it was something that I could flex to my fourth grade friends at recess. You ate mac and cheese? Well, guess what? I ate snake. It was a badge of honor. You know, most folks I know have their own version of this, a food story that becomes part of their personal lore, a symbol of not just a meal, but an achievement. It reveals a sense of worldliness or bravery. And nothing embodies this quite like the annual dinner for the Explorers Club in New York City, a gala event hosted every year since 1904. Over the years, the menu has included unusual items like elephant stew, manta ray curry, lion burgers, scorpion canapes, and different species and flavors of cockroaches. Of all the dishes the Explorers Club has served, none is as legendary as a small appetizer served at the annual dinner in 1951. Here's how the club promoted it.
Just think what you'll be able to tell your friends and family that you actually did eat prehistoric meat of some 250,000 years ago.
That prehistoric meat? Woolly mammoth. Over the years, the legendary woolly mammoth appetizer has endured in Explorers Club lore, along with some lingering questions. Today on Proof from America's Test Kitchen, what did the Explorers Club diners actually eat at that infamous 1951 dinner? I'm Kevin Pang. You'll want to hold onto your tusks for this one. Stick around. Reporter Doug Mack brings us today's story.
The Explorers Club is a place of legends. The organization was established in 1904, and it's based on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, inside a historic building that projects an aura of old money. Meticulously maintained brown brick with Gothic flourishes, including leaded glass windows and an arch over the front entrance. Inside, there's lots of dark wood paneling and mounted animal heads and portraits of famous members who include Teddy Roosevelt, Robert E. Peary, who claimed to be the first person to reach the North Pole, and Roald Amundsen, the first person to reach the South Pole. The first time I heard about the club was when I was a kid. I have a vague, awestruck memory of seeing it mentioned in some swashbuckling adventure story that was probably half reality and half a ripoff of Indiana Jones. I was a curious kid, but not especially adventurous. I was terrified of the potential dangers lurking around every corner of my own neighborhood, but I liked the idea of striding off to the most remote corners of the world. And here were people who did just that, who put on their flying goggles, hopped in a biplane, guided only by their curiosity and a bottomless confidence that they'd return with some amazing stories to tell. But when it comes to the Explorers Club as a whole, there's probably no legend as notorious or as vexing as the 1951 annual dinner. Tickets started at $9.50, equivalent to about $116 today. The 500 men in attendance were New York's elite, donned in tuxedos and smelling of luxury. Mammoth wasn't the only thing on the menu. There were also spider crabs from the Pacific Ocean, huge things with long, long legs. Two of them framed the doorway leading into the event. There were also bison steaks and cheese straws and chestnuts, green turtle soup, and cocktails made with ice flown in from the Juneau ice field in Alaska. But the mammoth was the clear star. Here was an iconic creature, huge and shaggy and very much extinct. The last one died around 10,000 years ago. But the club boasted that this particular mammoth was 250,000 years old. The club said that the meat had been found by miners in the Aleutian Islands in Alaska. It had been roasted in a volcano all those centuries ago before being preserved in ice. The Explorers Club had talented copywriters. They described it like this.
First cooked in the pit of Hades, and then as quickly placed in Mother Nature's quick freeze to remain as good as new unto eternity.
That last sentence has 3 exclamation points, by the way. Some diners said it tasted like veal. Others said it was more like roast beef. Either way, it wasn't the flavor that people truly enjoyed. It was the story behind this glacier-to-table meal. Newspaper columnist Alan Rankin called it the century's rarest dinner and wondered how many Alka-Seltzers will be needed to chase it. In the Omaha World Herald, it just said, "Here is meat, really aged." Rankin's tone summed up much of the coverage at the time, wavering between, "Wow, this is kind of cool," and, "Oh boy, those rich weirdos are at it again." He held the event at arm's length, saying that an Explorers Club member had courteously invited him, but
"I have, I hope, as courteously, declined."
Rankin was also dubious about the actual age of the meat. The club had said it was 250,000 years old, but he was certain it couldn't be more than 25,000. Other news accounts went the other direction. The Sydney, Australia Daily Telegraph quoted a club member who said it was 3 million years old, but no one really seemed to know. From the outside, the event was interesting, but more than a bit inscrutable.
I was a student employee at the Yale Peabody Museum of Natural History. I was working in the vertebrate zoology collection, and we had this jar of meat in the collections.
This is Dr. Jessica Glass, who is an assistant professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks in the College of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. That jar of meat she's talking about was a decades-old piece of leftovers from the Explorers Club dinner in 1951. It had been preserved by a club member named Paul Griswold Howes. He'd paid for a ticket but was unable to attend the dinner, so he asked for his serving to be sent to him, not to eat, but to keep in the Bruce Museum in Greenwich, Connecticut, where he was the curator. In 2001, the specimen was donated to the Peabody Museum at Yale, where Jessica first encountered it as an undergraduate in 2011. 3 years later, as a PhD student, she returned to the jar after one of her professors suggested that someone take a closer look at it.
"Hey, by the way, we have this really cool specimen. If anyone ever wants to do a DNA analysis, like, come and let me know." And I was like, I ran to the front of the room, like, "Yeah, I do." So it was preserved in a jar of ethanol, and previously it had been in isopropanol, which was great. It meant that we could still get DNA out of it. It looked like a very stringy gray color, and we had pretty, you know, overall there's probably only the size of a deck of cards, but it was broken up into some smaller chunks. It was very unappetizing, first of all, and to the point where I was like, "Oh, this is just so gross. I can't believe people ate this." Imagine like a dry chicken skewer that was gray colored.
Truly gross. But on the outside of the jar was a specimen card, which said something perplexing.
This is the meat of Megatherium, found and dug out of Arctic tundra.
Megatherium. That's not woolly mammoth. That's giant sloth. An entirely different extinct animal. The label didn't match the legend.
So it happens, the TA, the teaching assistant for that class, Matt Davis, was a member of the Explorers Club, and he said, no, they didn't eat sloth, they didn't eat Megatherium. The 1951 dinner is famous for woolly mammoth. They ate woolly mammoth at that dinner. Everyone knows that. And so off the bat, there was this mystery with this specimen that had been very well preserved in museums for 60 years of, is this sloth or is this mammoth? And we had the time and expertise and tools and team to figure that out.
The first time I heard about this story, years ago, it took me right back to those swashbuckling books I read as a kid, and to Indiana Jones movies and that whole sense of brazenness and adventure. I did grow up to become a travel writer, but I still wouldn't consider myself adventurous. I'm not joking when I say that my first published travel story was about how no matter where I went, I only wanted to eat chicken in its various forms. The story was called Confessions of a Chicken Man. But I wasn't proud of that trepidation. I wanted some of that Explorers Club swagger and willingness to see it all, do it all, eat it all. If you're truly guided by a sense of openness, who cares if it's mammoth or sloth? Either way, we're talking ancient animals, extinct, flown in from a tiny island thousands of miles away. Food that not only has a sense of place, but a sense of time, imported from an entirely different era. But the more details I learned about the 1951 event, the more complicated my feelings became. The entertainment at the dinner included lectures on a valley in New Guinea and the ribbon-tailed bird of paradise. But there was also something called the Ethnological Follies, featuring, quote, girls chosen as the highest feminine beauty throughout the geographic earth. Yeah, pretty gross, and all the more so considering that women weren't even allowed to attend the dinner. The club explicitly banned women from becoming members, a firm rule that had stood since 1929, when the club's members, all men, held a vote and unanimously agreed to bar women from both the club and the clubhouse. The Explorers Club didn't allow women to join as members until 1981. In addition to that horrifying sexism, the early history of the club was one where genuine scientific inquiry often intersected with a brash sense of exoticism and conquest. When I read travel stories, even today, or sit down to write my own, it can be hard to find the line between earnest inquiry and something more colonialist. Demanding that a place or culture give you something to take home, a story, a souvenir, or answers to personal questions, it can be difficult to stay on the right side of that line, even if you try. But when I read dispatches from Explorers Club members in those early days, many of them didn't even care about that line. For many of these men, most of them wealthy and white and already wielding plenty of power, exploration was a brash exercise in treating other people, places, cultures, and ecosystems as collectibles to be gathered or plundered and then stashed in a trophy cabinet. To give one example from just a few years earlier, in 1948, club member Hassel Davis traveled to a remote mountain region in northern Brazil.
He returned to New York after a 5.5-month expedition, which was the first ever to venture into the region and come back intact. One group of 50 lost 49 of its members. The survivor happened to be asleep in a tree, hidden by leaves, when the group was attacked by the Oyakule, or Long Ear Indians.
It's all very breathless and swaggering, layered with a sense of danger and exoticism. Jessica Glass had become fixated on the mystery of whether the meal was mammoth or giant sloth. But the unshakable question in my mind was more philosophical. Why did the Explorers Club offer this meal in the first place? To what end?
It's funny because the example was surprising to me from a historical perspective. Like, I didn't know about this example, but it was not surprising at all in terms of, like, contemporary ways that high-status people, especially high-status men, distinguish their food habits from the everyday person.
That's Jose Johnston, a food sociologist at the University of Toronto. I spoke to her and her research partner and colleague at the university, Sean Bauman. As Jose and Sean explained to me, part of the story here is simply a matter of exotic meat of any kind carrying its own form of status during the 1950s. Everyday Americans were increasingly eating mass-produced meat, usually roast chicken, pork chops, or ground beef. So if you wanted to maintain your own sense of superiority in what you ate, less attainable meat was one way to do it. It's the same timeless cultural phenomenon you see with bands and art and literature. Once a product gains mass appeal, the cool kids move on. A true explorer seeks exclusivity.
It's kind of like the food is tacked on to an adventuring culture or a kind of a colonial culture where these people who had a lot of material resources and a cultural framing of like the world is my oyster just thought that they were entitled to have anything they wanted. And that included, yeah, they had the show of the women of all the different ethnicities from around the world to give them a show and display all the different kinds of beauty. And I feel like the food is just on par with that. It was just another way in which they were taking everything and using it for themselves.
We know that at a structural level, those kinds of rare consumption events do generate a kind of status for people who are able to participate in them. So it does seem like a class story and a gendered story too, which is so clearly articulated in this idea of this being an explorer's club.
But any quest for a rarefied product will eventually lead to a stumbling block. How do you get it if no one else can? With the woolly mammoth, or giant sloth, how likely is it that the Explorers Club actually got its hands on ancient meat? Like, is that a real thing that has happened anywhere else? People just dig frozen animals out of the ice and decide to have a bite or two? Well, apparently, it has happened. One of Jessica Glass's colleagues at the University of Alaska, Dale Guthrie, has even eaten something remarkably similar to that infamous Explorers Club meal. A 50,000-year-old bison that had been discovered in permafrost by gold miners around 1979. They notified Guthrie, who dug it up, named it Blue Babe, and got to work studying it, learning everything he could about the life of this animal. In 1984, he and his colleagues decided to take some of the frozen pieces of meat and make it into a stew. He later reported that it tasted a little muddy, but it wasn't that bad. Quote, not so bad that we couldn't each have a bowl. So it wasn't entirely outside the realm of possibility that the Explorers Club really had gotten a hold of ancient frozen meat. And Jessica Glass knew that her sample of sloth, or mammoth, came from a reliable source.
Father Bernard Rosencrantz Hubbard was a very famous explorer. He led several expeditions to the Arctic. He was based at Santa Clara University. It was he and Captain George Costco of the U.S. Navy that organized the shipment of glacial ice from Juneau, Pacific spider crabs, lichen, all of these sort of exotic Arctic food items were sent to New York City for the dinner.
These were reputable men, so if they claimed to have found something, no one questioned it. They weren't prone to lying. And if Hubbard and Costco did find either mammoth or giant sloth on the Alaskan island of Akutan, it would have been a big deal at the time, because these animals had never been known to exist there. Megatherium had never been found outside Central America, and while woolly mammoth had been found in other Aleutian islands, there was no other evidence of them on this island. This little specimen was so much more than an appetizer. It had implications for scientists' understanding of the Bering Land Bridge, glaciation patterns, and how Pleistocene mammals moved around, which made it all the more important for Jessica to find out the truth.
The work that we have to do for ancient DNA is very specific. Because that DNA is degraded, it's broken down, it can very, very, very easily get contaminated. And so you can't go into a regular DNA lab and then walk into the ancient DNA lab because you'll have DNA on your clothes that could contaminate the sample. So I'm wearing like a lab coat. It's all UV sterilized. I have a mask, a head covering. Like I looked like kind of a mummy in that lab by myself, just like really nervous when I first got the piece of meat and used a little scalpel to try to get right into the middle where it would be least likely to be contaminated. And we actually first saw there was DNA. It was really exciting. So then the question was, well, what do we think it is?
After the break, Jessica solves the mystery of what exactly the Explorers Club served at that dinner in 1951. And now, back to our story. We'll pick it up as Jessica Glass is starting to test the meat from the Explorers Club annual dinner from 1951.
Jessica's first task was to extract the DNA from the meat. A painstaking process, especially when dealing with a specimen that's thousands of years old. So, she's in this special clean room at Yale with this whole outfit on to avoid any contamination. She takes 5 samples of the meat, which she's air-dried to remove the ethanol, and she mixes the samples with a couple of other things. Then she has to let them sit, 18 hours at 40 degrees Celsius. Then she adds some more proteinase K and lets it incubate for another 12 and a half hours. After that, there's some centrifuging and some purification. I don't really follow all of it, to be honest, but you can read the paper she wrote about it. In the end, once the DNA was extracted, Jessica compared it to the DNA sequence of the other animals she thought it could be. It's a matter of comparison. Does it look like this other thing we already know about?
It's sort of anticlimactic and dramatic at the same time, because what you spend all this time in the lab, you're super careful, you send it out for sequencing, you know, you're amplifying this region of the genome. So we could say, okay, well, if we think it's these, let's take the sequence that we get and compare it to the database. And ultimately it comes down to sitting on a computer and like plugging in the sequence onto the website. And you wait a few seconds and you see the little window saying, oh, identifying the match. And then poof, you get a species on the screen or several species that show a percent match. And I remember sitting in my office with Matt, just like so excited. And sure enough, it was Chelonia mitis.
Chelonia mitis. That's not mammoth and it's not giant sloth. It's green sea turtle. Very common, very much not extinct, and also conveniently something that was already on the menu that night in a soup.
When I was doing the research about what we needed to do in the lab, Matt Davis dug into the archives to see, like, what is the history of this thing?
Matt Davis spent months poring over newspaper articles and documents from the Explorers Club, looking for any mention of Father Hubbard and Captain Costco, the two men who had sourced the food for that fateful dinner at the Roosevelt Hotel. But there was nothing. Until
Matt found a, one could say, confession in the Explorers Club journal.
It was a note from the chair of the Explorers Club dinner, a man named Wendell Phillip Dodge.
Dodge said, could there be a potion for which we could change Chelonia mitis into Megatheria?
In other words, is there some magic potion that will change green sea turtle into giant sloth?
And so we were just like, this is just kind of weird.
Matt also found correspondence between Dodge and Paul Howes, the guy who had ordered the takeout meal and put it in his museum.
Wendell Phillips Dodge personally filled out the specimen label and wrote Megatherium.
Again, that's giant sloth, but that's not what most newspapers were reporting.
Paul Howes, of course, reads the Christian Science Monitor article and says, wait, this is mammoth.
Howes writes to Wendell Phillips Dodge, like, hey man, which animal is it?
And at one point, Dodge says in all capitals, it is sloth, and then goes on this whole kind of rant in the correspondence about pteropods and blah, blah, blah. And it doesn't really make any sense. It's very confusing.
It was all a ruse. A prank. Played on the high society men who showed up to the Explorers Club dinner that night, swindled into paying for prehistoric meat. And by the way, there's no record that any of them had any idea about it. They just took this outlandish tale at face value because some other well-traveled men had told them to. It's difficult to imagine that none of the guests would have asked rigorous questions about where the meat came from. But this lack of deep inquiry wasn't exactly unheard of in the Explorers Club. Some 40 years earlier, a member named Frederick Cook had claimed to have been the first person to reach the North Pole. But it soon became clear that his documentation didn't add up, and he hadn't actually made it to the pole. The Explorers Club expelled him. His acquaintance Robert Peary, a 2-term president of the club, then claimed that he had reached the North Pole, although his account has largely been discredited as well. There's something unnerving about stories like these, When tales of exploration turn out to be untrue, it's not only embarrassing, it's hurtful. It's disrespectful to the places and people at the far end of those journeys. But when hundreds of wealthy men get duped in their desire to have an authentic, exotic experience imported to New York for their amusement, I'll laugh at that. The joke's on them. All that elitist bragging, all that lore over green sea turtle. Something that, at the time, anyone could have had in a can of Campbell's soup.
Yeah. Yeah, he got everyone. He got everyone for 60 years.
There's a lingering question here for me. Why put extinct meat on the menu in the first place? Not just exotic meat. I get that, even if it makes me recoil a bit. But this is a truly fancy event, and they're serving the world's oldest leftovers? Something about that just didn't quite compute. Here's Sean Bauman again to help me break it down.
I think it's not just about the conspicuousness of the consumption. It's a particular kind of conspicuousness that does break norms around what's socially acceptable or common in terms of an animal to eat and gets into the territory of exotic meat, which is, we know from a lot of different research, is one way that people are able to position themselves culturally as distinct from a lot of other consumers.
For New Yorkers of the 1950s, eating, say, green turtle was not quite norm-breaking. But ancient meat? That was genuinely shocking and something that not even the attendees could hope to repeat. It was a truly once-in-a-lifetime experience. No matter how far you travel or how much money you have, you'll surely never have the opportunity to eat an animal that's been extinct for thousands of years. Even for the elite, this was off-the-charts exoticism. Or at least that's presumably what they told themselves.
It reminds me of one quote we had in our research on foodies where a foodie told us that he ate goat testicles pickled in rice wine. And he said, like, I thought that was really cool. Like, he just said it explicitly. I thought that was cool. And that guy came to mind when I read this story.
Maybe it's not even about the experience of eating the meat. It's about the fact that you can say you did it. It took years, but eventually the Explorers Club started to shift its approach to its annual dinner, taking sustainability and conservation into account. The catalyst for this change actually came in 1984 from Prince Philip, Queen Elizabeth's husband. Apparently, Prince Philip had attended the dinner in 1983, which featured hippo liver pâté. He was so appalled to see an endangered species on the menu that he resigned his honorary membership and canceled his plans to attend the 1984 dinner. In hopes of winning him back and stemming the tide of bad publicity from the prince's protest, the club announced that no endangered species would be included on the menu in 1984. The British royals, of all people, setting Americans straight on the subject of culinary conquest? That's not a twist I would have predicted. This was the first real shift away from the previous attitudes and towards something at least a bit more conscientious, where swagger wasn't all that mattered at the Explorers Club annual dinner. In 1997, the menu featured hors d'oeuvres made with Indian water buffalo and pot-bellied pig from Laos, but also called out a wide variety of vegetarian items. 2 years later, there was llama loin and lion steak, but the club was careful and proactive in announcing that this was all farm-raised or licensed game and not killed in the wild. The club has changed in other ways, too, and it's begun to reflect on its legacy and history and the harms that came with the swagger and actions of years past. In 2021, the Explorers Club created a new program identifying 40 individuals under the age of 40 who were intended to define a new direction. They were field scientists, anthropologists, and expedition leaders. Bloomberg reported that, unlike the club's dominantly affluent male Eurocentric makeup, they represent true diversity in gender, race, socioeconomic status, and creed. Jessica Glass has had a front row seat for this evolution. The Mystery Meat Project was her first introduction to the Explorers Club.
Now I'm a fellow and I serve on grant committees and I help make the decisions to fund the new wave of explorers and scientists. And I'll say that a lot of who we fund are people that are in their own countries doing work important for conservation and sustainability for themselves and their communities. We funded an amazing woman studying baobab trees from Madagascar, an amazing gentleman who's studying chimpanzee behavior in Rwanda. And so for me, I'm able to make that change and prioritize that kind of science.
In the last decade, sustainability has become a staple on the menu at the Explorers Club annual dinner. Recent years have seen items like kangaroo meatballs, tempura tarantula, and honey-glazed scorpions. And the club has made a point of highlighting invasive species like lionfish, nutria, python, and iguana. The efforts highlight conservation goals and fit within a small but tangible trend of restaurants and chefs looking for ways to control these animal populations.
You don't want to ignore the climate crisis that's happening, so you're going to address an important issue. You're going to address species, invasive species. But on the other hand, you want to do it in a way that gives you some kind of status points that makes it look special or elite or fancy or cool in some way. And that menu item just brilliantly balances the two impulses.
And I fully agree that this is an improvement. So much better not to eat extinct or endangered animals. You can have a sense of curiosity and exploration without that. And the club deserves credit for changing what kind of work it supports, with goals of equity and sustainability coming to the forefront. And yet, there's still something that feels off about this new and improved version of the Explorers Club annual dinner. If the appeal in 1951 was scarcity, it's now become squeamishness, things that might not be rare but feel different and gross for the sort of person who can shell out $950 for even the cheapest tickets. The theme for this year's dinner, which was held on April 20th, was a cosmic ballet, and the club promised an evening of astronauts, aquanauts, alpinists, and insects of every flavor. The main course options were short rib or tandoori-spiced cauliflower steak, but only the insects got a shout-out in the event invitation, because those are the kinds of foods that have become synonymous with the Explorers Club. It's part of the whole appeal of the event. And when you look through the social media posts from the annual dinners in recent years and the overall tone of today's press coverage, it's clear that these dishes still embody the sort of privileged cheekiness that would be very familiar to the tuxedo-wearing men who thought they were feasting on ancient meat back in 1951. People around the world eat insects all the time. In many cultures, it's just no big deal. It's just food. But at the Explorers Club, it's a winking symbol of something exotic and kind of creepy. It's an Instagram-ready juxtaposition between what they perceive as highbrow and lowbrow culture. Dress up, eat an insect, and be sure to post your selfie with the right hashtag. It's their own brand of conspicuous consumption. We all do this in our own ways, of course. I post about food when I travel too, especially now that I eat much more than chicken. And while my selfies don't include roasted tarantulas or woolly mammoth, the underlying impulse is still there. Food carries so many emotions, and when a meal taps into our sense of pride or wonder or achievement, it feels natural to share that with other people and say, I have an amazing story to tell you. The stakes and signifiers of what food makes you cool have changed over the last generation, and you can see a lot of that in the evolution of the Explorers Club menu during that time. But the annual dinner is also a good indication of what hasn't changed, and a reminder of the questions that are always worth asking, not to remove the joy of the moment, but to put it in perspective. Why do we eat outside our comfort zones? Is it genuine curiosity and a desire to connect with the world? Or is it for bragging rights?
Thanks to Doug Mack for bringing us today's story. If you like Proof, be sure to subscribe wherever you listen so you'll get new episodes as soon as they drop. And while you're there, why not leave us a rating or write us a review? It really helps other people find the show. This episode of Proof is hosted by me, Kevin Pang, and the podcast is made by the following cast of characters.
I'm Yumi Araki, the managing producer.
I'm executive producer Caitlin Kelleher.
I'm supervising producer Caroline Rickard.
I'm producer Alex Curran Cardarelli.
I'm associate producer Angelica Quintanilla.
I'm Bridget Lancaster, creator and the founding host and producer.
Audio services are provided by Ultraviolet Audio, with sound design supervision by
Matt Boynton.
Scoring, mixing, and sound design by
Anya Gzeshik.
Brian Campbell of Signal Sounds composer theme music, additional music by Kyle Forster and Jordan Pearson.
Chen Margolis
is our director of post-production, and our director of production is
Diane Knox.
Fact-checking and additional research by
Sarah D. Collins.
Special thanks to Amanda Stanley, Brody Sandel, and everyone who spoke to Doug for this story. Thanks also to our colleague Yorgos Trivanidis for his voice acting.
Jack Bishop
is the Chief Creative Officer, and Dan Surratt is America's Test Kitchen's CEO. Thanks to our sponsor, Pluga Premium Butter. Proof is a production of America's Test Kitchen.